Hey everyone, my name is Christopher Price. Welcome back to another edition of the Patriots Report right here on the Believe Network. Today's guest, Matt Chatham, former Patriots linebacker, three-time Super Bowl champion. He's going to let us know what he thinks about the Patriots draft, about some of the things that they've done post-draft as well as post-free agency. He's also going to tell us a little bit about Vince Wilfork and why Vince was such a special player and why he not only deserves a spot in the Patriots Hall of Fame, but in Canton as well. But first, want to let you guys know today's episode is brought to you by Bet Online. Our partners at Bet Online continue to be the number one source for all your betting needs and sports information. Find all the latest odds, news, and sports developments for the NBA playoffs, Major League Baseball fights, and NFL futures. Bet Online is your continued source for all sports wagering needs, including live betting and the fan favorite Vegas casino and poker games. It's really easy to get started. Head to the website or use your mobile device to sign up now and use our promo code BLEAV, that's B-L-E-A-V, to receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Bet Online, where the game starts. Now let's get to our conversation with Matt Chatham. Matt, I want to start with this. You had some very pointed thoughts on the criticism that some had of the Patriots' decision to draft Cole Strange at 29. Give me your thoughts on the decision to select him and explain some of the back and forth that you went through with folks on social media.
So I think arguments like these often sort of kick off because of maybe a wrong perception or sort of a starting point that everyone sort of agrees to that may very well be false or was never challenged. And I think the notion that somehow guards can't be a first-round value is something that I think was carried around a lot of people. I personally was advocating for the kid from for Boston College as a possibility if we were talking several months before the draft. And but that would obviously set off people that were excited to see a weapon or whatever, right? But I think a lot of people, this notion sort of got floated, guard is not a position of value and for a first round. I mean, yes, they're, you know, it's important, but you can get them at other places. But I don't, if you just simply accepted that to be true, I think you would be misinformed because it's a perpetual thing each year where there are multiple guards taken in a given draft class. I think I actually have it here in front of me in some old notes I was going through. I'll pull it up real quickly. So in this last one, we had three. In 2021, there were two. In 19, two. So they did skip in 20. In 18, two. 16, two. 17 must have skipped as well. But the oddball thing here, though, that happened was, and again, we're not talking about like the 29th, 30th, and 31st pick each year. I mean, in a given year, we're talking about the 6th overall, the 11th overall, 14th, 14th, 17th, 17th, 15th, 17th. You know, this is, we're not talking about low value, bottom of first, question of whether or not to take him in the second kind of thing. And we're also not talking about sort of the also ran GMs of the NFL. A lot of these guys, Chris Ballard, I mean, go down the list. Just in this last season, who was it from Tom Telesco out there at the Chargers? I mean, that's sort of the new nouveau sort of organization. And I don't recall them getting all this blowback for taking a guard. Like, this is people that really value your quarterback, these young quarterbacks, the notion that the guy that's arm's length from him is not valuable is insane. I just don't think that makes a lot of sense. Now, granted, you don't often see as many of them go, of course. Tackles tend to go more. Why? I think, quite frankly, because you have three positions. You have there's a swing tackle, and there's only two guards, right? So in a given class, yeah, if a typical first round is going to have maybe four to five tackles, and you're going to need, like we've shown here, two to three guards, that's not that unusual. And they don't typically go nearly as high, and I think that's sort of derived from contract value. Well, you know, tackles are up making near $20 million now, and your top guards are in the lower double digits. So that stuff all makes sense. But if you had gone forth with the premise that a guard can't, shouldn't, won't be taken in the first, you were misled, because that's not true at all. And I think the other portion of it was, and again, I think it's equally crazy, given how A, run first they are, and how B, he is in close proximity, to having an elite player to the guy that you value most on the team and the quarterback. I just think it doesn't make a lot of sense to think that's somehow of lower or lesser value. Yeah, you could hit the jackpot and get, you know, Steve Neal, but you can also, or Shaq, another example, someone who was a little lower, but you also can guess high and get someone that walks in and starts on day one. In all those instances, I think the people would often mention, oh yes, but you got a Ryan Connolly at one point. You got Shaq, you got those guys. The unique thing about the heavy investment guys is they're presumed to walk in and play for you, right? So if it takes Cole a year or two to get going, then okay, it's a different story. Then maybe they missed on the wrong guy. But if they feel like they have a pro-ready thing, a starter, the minute he's there thing, that's different than what, again, guys I got a tremendous amount of respect for, like Ryan Lindell and Dan Connolly and Shaq and all the guys that were mentioned. Hey, you can get them later. They didn't walk in the door and play at high end starter level right off the bat. That's why you take them at this level. And so the other half of the argument, though, was this presumption that because a lot of draft evaluators have them as a second or third round, and I always have to be careful when I go to this line because I know some people will take it as if I'm mocking or deriding the guys that do that. I'm not, but we need to understand it's entertainment that I use. I'm an avid user of a lot of the names, you know, guys who do draft mocks, right? And a lot of those services and the brands that are behind them, I use them extensively for my own research for TV. I've done it for years. So it's not as if they're amateurs, or it's not as if they have no clue what they're talking about, but they are outside the game and it's for the purpose of entertainment. They're not tuned in to what someone's about to do. And the fears that one might have about not doing it because of internal information they have about where someone else might move behind. And that's what drives when you take one, not how they were sequentially numbered 1 to 100 positioned independently by a scouting service. That's completely irrelevant to the world of drafting. Draft day is about, we've targeted a guy, we highly value the guy, and then, oh man, two guards went off the board prior to us. And that hasn't happened in several drafts. So all of a sudden, if you really think between 3 and 4, 5, 6, 7, there's a massive drop off in quality and you're looking at a developmental guy, you got to take him. The idea that you took him at, you know, high 20s or low 30, whatever it was, as opposed to, 40 something or 50 where they originally sat, that gap is relatively immaterial overall in the argument. So I don't think people realized that presumed, hey, he'll still be there at 54. They didn't know the history, quite frankly. They didn't know the history that no, the third guard in the draft does not get that far. There's 6 years in a row history that absolutely does not happen. There was also a quirky little thing in the history that after the second goes, there was a 3-year run where the third guard went directly after them. So, you know, that's what organizations have is information, and that's what their sort of tangible fears are. It's not that we're not supposed to take them here. It's that we are in a situation we made a choice to let our really good guy go in free agent or in through a trade. So it's a very valuable position. We have to fill it. And the speculative fill could be a long-term project. And that's not what they were looking to do. It looks like they went and did the sort of savvy thing in the moment and got a good player. If he ended up being a good player, then it was a bad move. If he ends up being a great player, it was a great move. And it's really that simple. The notion of value off of an aggregate of people outside the game is not real. It's like the WWE. Again, I enjoy it, but that's what it is.
What about the idea that, look, I understand that guys like Stephen Neal and maybe even to some extent Ryan Wendell are maybe outliers, or can't really be measured like this. But what about the idea that they are going to start putting more of an investment in offensive linemen because Dante Scarnecchia is not there, with the idea that maybe those guys who had a chance to be coached up, the Stephen Neals, the Dan Conleys, those type of guys, and again, this is not a shot at them, but those type of guys are not going to get a chance to be coached up by someone like Dante Scarnecchia. So the theory is, look, we need to invest in day one guys, not just for the protection of Mac Jones, but for the overall development of our offensive line.
I mean, it's possible, but I think one of the things that we've seen as this thing is configured is you do sort of have slotted guys. You know, you sort of have, you know, your left tackle is a former first rounder of yours. You know, your presumptive left guard is somebody you've now taken in the first round. Your right guard was a low draft pick, but you hit a home run. I mean, everyone loved him. He's the highest grading rookie offensive lineman in the entire NFL. And then you've invested with a really, really smart and sort of under market value right tackle deal with Trent Brown. So, and your long-term sort of stalwart guy in the middle and David. So I just think they've kind of got what they've got. Mm-hmm. So the developmental guys are still going to be there. I think Matty P is going to have a great opportunity to in his own right, sort of, you know, kind of carve his own path. But those guys don't have to do it this year, right? So he's going to have an opportunity to target two or three guys or whatever within that room that might one day become swing guard tackle guys, or swing interior guys, or a guy that becomes the third tackle. Maybe it's somebody still on the roster. Maybe it's somebody new that we don't know. But one thing I will simply say is I spend every one of these years where I've done podcasts or done stuff on SN where we would hammer what were keys to a game. And I know it's popular to talk about the blind sides and the edges and sort of where sacks come from, but week in, week out, especially with, say, a team like the Chiefs with Chris Jones as an interior sort of Kelly Rush or the Aaron Donalds of the world. Like, the porch matters just as much as the edges. And I don't think people get that, you know, because the tackle's paid more, ergo he's more important. Yeah, but that part of the pocket isn't necessarily more important for the quarterback to have comfort in to throw it. It's not. I mean, that's not even arguable. If you watch how a pocket forms on a given play, the place where you – there's a, and this is important as well, because you won't get this from a for an outside service grade. Yes, you can get really serviceable, good starter-level play at guard from guys in later rounds. There's a massive, massive difference from an elite player and a good player. Mm-hmm. An elite player will just stop things at the line of scrimmage, give you two, three, you know, an additional stride or two to step into a throw. A guy with a clean pockets, a guy that they won't rush over with their best people because it's a waste one-on-one. The guy that's an absolute killer, if you got one, I'm not saying we know that that's the case, but if you got one, a killer at guard, that on run plays, you can run behind and get first downs over and over and over again throughout the course of the game. That's incredibly valuable. The quarterback does most of his good work not stepping into throws behind a tackle. It's stepping into throws in his front line. So that's why this position matters. And it's not that those names you mentioned weren't awesome Patriots. They were. Mm-hmm. But if you get a Mankins type who takes whoever the hell's over him and puts him on the other side of the line of scrimmage, the quarterback has this giant sort of Kramer interstate to drive and swerve. Like, and that's incredibly valuable. People would be surprised. It'd be fun for fans to get a chance, maybe through VR or something like that, to try to play quarterback and try to complete these throws. You know what would make it easier for them to do it? Not the quality of the receiver that's out there running the route, the comfort around him. The guys that can put them in a rather than in a phone booth, put them in sort of an 8x8 office. And that makes completing to whoever the hell it is out there running the route, provided they're competent pros are getting open, they'll get it done. Right. So I just think there's a reverse thinking in part because of how fantasy football works, that you presume the guy catching it somehow more valuable than the space you were given to complete it, whoever you wanted to. That's backwards. That's not how it works. So I think they get it. And I think the building inside out, both sides of the ball, is where the smart teams are going to do it.
Being able to step into that throw consistently, really, I would think when you're talking about a young quarterback like Mac Jones, being able to build that confidence, I would think would certainly not just help your running game, obviously, because you do have that strong interior line, but also help out the passing game to be able to get him from a level from here to here that maybe we didn't see on a consistent basis last year, not through no fault of his own, but just it just was not there for him as a rookie.
Yeah, I think like with any position, like you would see this. I mean, I could use another example on some other part of the defense or anywhere else in the offense. There is a gap between good and great. There is. And it's not to deride what good is, because you love having good. But if you really, truly have great at something, there's this new sort of opportunity around it, right? And the thing that I would look at with – so for a situation like Mac, Mac can run. Mac is closer to like a Burrow. I know they mentioned that Burrow's 40 times or a little better and all that. But, I mean, he's closer to a guy that can lead and get pickup first downs. But he's not a guy like Lamar who's going to just run all day. But what's important about that kind of guy, he can take off and go. He's not going to take off and go around the edge. You don't run a boot. You're not dashing outside the pocket. He's leaving back down through the pocket. And where's the best way to go? Well, the guy that's stoned at the line of scrimmage, the guard, those guys not getting worked over. It's really tough for you to go scramble if you've given up 4 yards of push in your lap. I mean, if you want the guy that runs good but not great to take off and have avenues, A, you want that space so he can throw from behind it. And B, if he's got to leave, it'd be great to have a guy locked up over him who's dominating his matchup. And it's in his lap. It's not out to his peripheral. So I think that's why this stuff matters. And you're not going to be unhappy if he ends up being a great player, which you hope you got if you took him where you took him. But you're not going to be unhappy with the results of having a great player in that spot with this guy.
I was joking with Bob Soucy last week about a group of guys. I refer to them, the list of them, as the, oh yeah, these guys are also on the roster group of players. Guys like Cameron McGrone, yeah. Raekwon McMillan, Mack Wilson, three linebackers with some of the offseason moves the Patriots made. It would appear they have those guys, those three specifically, have a real opportunity. What are some of the things that they need to show this offseason at OTAs and camp that could allow them to seize this chance?
Well, I think particularly with McMillan, because he has starting experience in a couple of different places, but then when injured, they just want to make sure he's the same guy, you know, because they are obviously fond of him, brought him in for that reason. Mac, on the other hand, is, you know, he's just a recent starter, and he's that different body type. He's clearly, you know, distinct, not better, but distinct and able, you know, than a guy like Hightower was. So it's kind of going in the way of the different body type, and presuming he does what he did there, they'll be pleased. I think with McGrone, it's just that all the promise that we saw, you know, can he, after working behind the scenes but not getting to do it live, is he able to do it on week one? I mean, there is a mild gamble here, of course. I mean, at least getting the trade situation from Cleveland is less gamble, because you have a full-time starter who's just sliding over into your world, and he's a little different kind of player than what you have. But in the other two situations, McMillan has been in, you know, three spots in a relatively short career. So you're hoping that, you know, that there are no more bumps. And if physical limitations come up again, well, then, you know, that gamble didn't work. But if you have, you know, one of the three hit, I guess, considering that you still have Bentley, he's a really underrated player. And Bentley doesn't, you know, has the hammer in the middle of a 3-4, or even is the mic in a 4-3. He doesn't have to run all over the place. He has to go guard to guard, tackle to tackle at most. But you do have that other body type, and potentially any of those three guys that will, who can do that thing that people think, you know, they don't see as much of. But I wouldn't, let's put it this way. I wouldn't overemphasize the notion of hitting a home run with one of those two players. You get a nice solid contribution there somewhere this year, and that's very helpful. Don't forget that, like, a Jabril Peppers or one of the other big safeties on the back end, the way people play nickel these days, or any other sub configuration where it's a multi-DB kind of thing, start to think of those guys as your box players as well. They're not going to sit over the guards necessarily, but they're going to come down and fill late. They're going to be part of blitz packages. They're just sort of late add-ins. And if you weren't happy with their ability to chase down tosses or something like that in the run, which I think, you know, towards the end of the year, it was a fair criticism that they don't play make outside the numbers from the inside as much. But if you want to overcompensate and get that going more and see more of those kinds of plays, they might come from mid-depth as opposed to down in box. You know, it might come from safety bodies, and they have seemingly more of those now. They're really loading up on the back end for versatile inside the numbers, but maybe not necessarily the box kind of guys. Now, I say that, and it's going to be fun, because, you know, I would put him in the oh yeah kind of category. Jabril, especially because he's coming off of an injury, is probably in that oh yeah, I forgot we had him. And using McGrone in that way, it's not that I was championing the guy, because I saw the same highlights everyone did from Michigan stuff. Hey, looks good to me. You know, I don't do draft direction stuff, but he seemed like the kind of guy that if slide him up two or three rounds this year because of an absence of an injury, you know, everyone would be thrilled right now that you got Cameron McGrone. So that's kind of where things sit. And maybe we overestimated the notion of a need there, that they realized with better information, because they get to see him every day, that they already had those things taken care of.
Well, that's the argument that one of the reasons why they did not go get a linebacker at 29, that they like the guys who are in the building already, whether it's, you know, McMillan or McGrone or whatever the case may be. One other question on that point, and I'm glad you bring up the, you know, the safeties. It seems to me that one of the easier ways to get faster on defense is to be able to get guys like Kyle Duggar, Adrian Wilson, and Jabril Peppers into your system, those bigger safeties who can almost play like linebackers. And it feels like we're kind of trending in that direction a little bit. That is, if Peppers hits.
Yeah. I mean, that's really the idea here, that you have more guys. And again, there's this kind of weird, I don't know how to describe this through an audio only format, but it's it's a strong safety that is in sort of proximity to the box, because he's sort of rolled down on maybe a slot or a flex tight end or something. He's not technically inside the tackle box, but if there's off tackle run his way, he's involved in one of the gap responsibilities, right? If there's toss, he may very well be the force player. If there's outside zone, he may very well be by assignment supposed to get that. So the thing about lighter linebackers, the times where I think people saw sort of the absence of the air quote playmaking is if you get into a third and eight or nine and you get in a catch and run situation, or you got in draw, or they, you know, or you got in spots where the guys that were just studs like Hightower and Van Noy and those guys are, and even Jamie Collins, it's a little different on first and second down when everything's all tightened up, and then when it's later and there's a little more space. So I caution people, because this happens in coaching, right? Where you just fired or got rid of or moved on from the disciplinarian, and you want the players coach guy. Mm-hmm. And then a year or two later, you're going, well, I now see the vacancy of the trade-off. I got that thing that we never had, but now I'm missing the other thing, right? So I know people are so excited. You're going to see the toss plays, right? You're going to see, wow, you see the guy that went sideline to sideline and stepped too fast from the other guy. Okay, that's cool. What about direct run? make sure that you're not getting blown off the ball and you're not as good at the other part as well. So that does happen a lot. An absence of those kind of plays is a very fair criticism of where they were this year. But there's a trade-off when you drop 20, 25, 30 pounds and ask them to do some of the things those guys did really well at. So that's where you hope that you're not going to ever be as good at direct as Dante was. You might be better at him on the outside stuff. So I think we just have to caution our sort of, enthusiasm for one thing without considering first what's given up.
We going to see Dante Hightower on this roster this year?
I don't know that. That's kind of why I couch in all these comments, because, there's possibility there you get into sort of a Mayo when he was a player, or like a Brewski late kind of thing. But, that's such an individual thing. It almost feels unfair to me to even guess or wonder on it, because it's just, what does the guy want to do? You know, what kind of sort of late years does he want to do or spend on a roster? And, maybe he does. I don't know him personally, so I can't sort of guess that he would want to do sort of the Pete Rose thing, and kind of have partial duty. Troy Brown obviously had some fun years there at the end where he was a much different role than we remember him as, but he was a huge contributor. I don't know. I don't know. Could he do it? Of course. Would seeing a player of that incredibly high caliber, in later years in a massively reduced role be something he wouldn't be comfortable with? I don't know that about him. I couldn't say one way or the other, but sometimes that goes into play where, a guy who's just a Pro Bowl level guy who's been that for most of his career is going to look around for opportunities here or otherwise. And again, I'm not talking about Dante. I'm just saying in general, and say, what I want to continue to do is what I've always done. And that's, if that's not available to me, then you often see guys of that sort of caliber not look for the other stuff. But there's other guys that are fully comfortable with, sliding in and finishing off a few years in a different role. But that's just a very individualistic thing. I don't know the person's sacrifice.
As a guy who played behind Vince Wilfork for a couple of seasons, we've all seen the highlights. We all saw what he was able to do for such a long time in the NFL as a member of the Patriots. I'd be interested in hearing from you, from a linebacker's perspective, what made Vince special? What did he do maybe that made it easier for you guys to operate within the framework of that defense?
The guards don't get the offensive guards don't get off the nose and climb to the mic at will. And that's about as simple as I can say it. They never get to you, because if they let off Vince is going to put the center into the quarterback's lap, or he's going to, drive him back into the running back and just take the ball from him. So the guards have to hang longer on Vince, because Vince is such an incredibly dominant human being. So I don't remember if this was with Vince or if this was with Keith Trailer. I know it wasn't with Big Ted Washington, because that was earlier, but you'll recall there was a season there where when Brew had his ailment, his heart thing. What was it? The stroke. Mm-hmm. When Brew had a stroke and was out for a while, I had to slide in and learn middle linebacker, which I, one of the two inside linebackers, which I had never done, and played a bunch of reps there for a handful of games doing that. And I had no clue what the hell I was doing. And, big Ted Johnson's still on those teams. And Ted would talk with me. Fife would talk with me. Roman Pfeiffer would talk with me. And a lot of it was like, when you're trying to learn this, what could make it most difficult is if snap of the ball while I'm trying to read some sort of run configuration, if it's a pulling guard or, misdirection from the backfield or what the blocking scheme is, where I got to fit to get my fill. It is so much more incredibly easy if the guard isn't climbing you. If you have a 1-1000, 2-1000, actually read it and hit it. But it's different if there's a screaming 6'4", 320-pound guy in your face that you're trying to both collision and see around to see your fit. And that's what dominant noses do. And I think I tweeted about this when I saw the news with Vince. It's really the same for Vince as it is for Big C. Seymour at the other spot. So it's really both those guys are doing the same thing, just in different places. They're occupying more people. Not that they have to be double teamed the entirety of the whistle, but they're making people, making the second guy hang longer enough to where the people by them get an advantage. Someone like me would love to have that advantage over a terrible pass rusher. So when you get to rush alongside Seymour, he's soaking them up and you're kind of just playing off him to make a play. And it's a little bit similar like that with a guy like Vince. Like if you're that guard, you can kind of just flow. Shoot, Ray Lewis for years. I mean, with having Kelly Gregg in earlier years, and I think it was Nada later, he'd always had,
Siragusa.
Goose with Tony. Yeah. I mean, just having beast in front of you allows you to just flow and make plays all day long. Doesn't have to worry about being hit immediately. And that's such a valuable thing. So, I mean, I'm not the guy who, yeah, I can wax poetic about it a little bit because I had to do it for a handful of games with Vince. I see the world more from the outside than that, but I just know when I was trying to learn it and figure it out, it's probably something I took for granted because it's not, it's probably not normal to not have them screen them up on you. But, I kind of grew up in a world where, hey, the end here is going to be a gold jacket guy. The guy over the nose should be a gold jacket guy. It's like everyone around you is doing this at a level that's not normal. You know, you probably take it for granted that it's not like that. It's not the look that every other linebacker.
Last question for me, setting aside the fact that Hall of Fame voters appear to prefer their defensive tackles to be pass rushers and not space eaters, make a case for Vince as a Pro Football Hall of Famer. Because I believe he can be. I believe he should be part of that conversation, but I'd be curious to hear from another player.
I think it's a slam dunk. And it has nothing to do with me playing with him. If I had this exact same profile and the guy happened to play for the Titans or the Chiefs or Dolphins or whatever it would be, if you had a guy that was that many Pro Bowls or All Pros, and I don't know the specific number, but it's at the threshold of what other guys are having that are flying through and into the Hall of Fame. Vince is in that level. If you're also of a position that is basically, it's stat independent. You know, there was the Cortez Kennedy was a good example of it years ago that got in, and it was just, you know, maybe he has a slight bit more pass rush to him, but shoot, Vince just didn't get it because he played nose in the 3-4. If Vince had spent his entire career in more of a sap type thing, he would have been
guy. Yeah. I mean, that's the guy that people love, the Hall of Fame voters, those big outsized personalities who pile up sacks.
Yeah. But I mean, Vince doesn't have those numbers necessarily because he played a true nose in the 3-4, which is just you absolutely shut down the middle of the field. Like nobody runs, you don't have backs running through A-gaps ever. They're not going there because Vince is there. And then here's the art. And I think this is how it should always sort of be formulated if you're going to try to figure out if a guy's work. We get into a lot of situations with guys who are going to be gold jacket guys that aren't necessarily all decade guys. They're often good, right? But that eventually you're going to get in. And that happens a lot and should happen. But in the case of Vince, if you were building his decade unit that would go out, he's on it. To me, that's the easiest possible way you could sort of do it. If you're putting a starting defense on the field for the decade of the 2010s or whatever, Vince is the nose. He's the nose. There's nobody else. So I don't understand. I don't need to know anything else. I don't even know if it was 5 all pros as opposed to 6 or 4 versus 6 or the number that were first team or second team, or if the Pro Bowls were 9 versus 7 or whatever the heck it was. I mean, that stuff's relatively immaterial. He played over 10 years, so he's a super long career. It's very versatile, and he stood up over time, right? It's not like a guy with a short pocket, so we're not talking about that. We're talking about if you had a starting defense, there's no question at the position of nose, and I'd give him the job over two decades, really. Mm-hmm. You know, he's the nose. Vince is the nose. He's the guy in the middle of your defense, and you would have a hard time picking a different – but there isn't a better option. You know, there might be some that are comparable, like Ndamukong Suh is kind of sort of similar, but he can play – I mean, he's really more of a 3 technique. He's not a – but there isn't a big over the nose that ever did it better than him. The only reason Vince will be slow – I hope it's not the case, but if he were slow to enter, it's just because of people valuing that position less. Mm-hmm. It's not that he isn't gold, sterling, whatever quality at the one that he had. That was his job, and he did it better than anyone ever had.
Matt, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate being able to hook this up. Hopefully we can connect again sometime between now and the start of training camp, my friend.
Sounds good. Thanks, buddy.
Take care.